Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading from the April/May 2024 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. So I hope you enjoy the program. This article is titled, Malawi's Island in the Sky. Mount Malanya is a climber's paradise and a casualty of logging. Can conservationists revive its forests? By Mark Jenkins. Mount Malanya, located at the southern end of Malawi in southern Africa, covers close to 400 square miles of steeply forested gorges and ancient stone summits. Rising more than 5,000 feet above the surrounding savanna, the massif was formed 130 million years ago, when magma, having cooled slowly beneath the surface of the earth, transformed into masses of crystallized granite. Over eons, the softer sedimentary rocks around the immense bulge of hard stone washed away. Today, the massif, known as an Inselberg, that's German for island mountain, is a world unto itself. Smoothly rounded stone mountains blanketed in green moss and black lichen, waterfalls tumbling from precipitous heights on all sides, rivers carving down through foothills of primeval forest and vanishing in the plains. Mount Malanya has the tallest rock wall on the African continent. Known as the west face of Shamba Peak, it extends 5,500 feet base to summit. Its scale is hard to grasp. Imagine Yosemite's El Capitan and Half Dome stacked on top of each other, with a forested terrace between the lower and upper walls. As an avid alpinist, I traveled to Malawi to climb a new route on this wall. Because Malanya is in the tropics, the granite has not been subjected to the timeless freeze-thaw cycles that split stone at higher altitudes and latitudes. Consequently, there were no cracks, which meant the surface was glass smooth and could not be ascended without placing bolts for protection. After a week of climbing with James Garrett, a veteran alpinist from Utah, we had drilled more than 30 bolts and completed a 2,000-foot route. Garrett had named it Passion and Pain, up to the featureless granite to reach the terrace. After we pulled up onto flat ground, we expected to find a forest, but all the trees had been chopped down and carried off the sides of the mountain. The Goliath upper wall loomed above us, but Garrett was set to return home, so we left the upper half of the west face for our next expedition. Shocked to see such deforestation, I decided to trek deep into the Malanya Mountains to uncover the reason for what I considered an environmental tragedy. En route, I intended to climb the highest peak in the entire range. Sepitwa, just shy of 10,000 feet, located in the Mount Malanya Biosphere Reserve, a UNESCO protected forest. I set out at 7:30 a.m. from the village of Likhubula on the west side of the range. With me was my guide and porter, Witness Stima. Stima is a quiet, good-natured, and extremely fit young man who is a subsistence farmer when he is not working as a mountain guide. He'd hiked the mountain many times and showed up with nothing more than an empty day pack and a jacket. No food, no knife, no trail map, no compass. He knew the path. At the start of the trail, before Likhubula Falls, a pleasant little pounding waterfall, I watched a local farmer catch a giant mottled freshwater eel with his bare hands. The eel was more than 3 feet long, weighed at least 15 pounds, and was writhing wildly, snapping its backward, curving, razor-sharp teeth. The man casually drove a stick down its throat and carried it away. Dinner for his family for a week. As is often the case with an early start, we moved swiftly and steadily. We planned to spend the night in the Chisipo hut, so our packs were light. No tent, stove, or cookware, just food, raincoats, and sleeping bags. Chisipo hut, at an elevation of 7,280, sits at the base of Sapitwa, almost a 5,000-foot climb. Our itinerary was a bit ambitious. Most people take 3 to 5 days to climb the mountain, first staying at huts at around 6,000 feet for acclimatization, then staying in the Chisipo hut the night before and the night after the ascent to the summit. But Stima, being so familiar with the routes, thought nothing of making a 2-day ascent. After 2 hours of tramping, we reached the Shambay Plateau, a rolling basin surrounded by high, bell-shaped granite walls. What I saw disappointed me. The entire basin had been clear-cut of trees. Given that we were in a UNESCO-protected forest, I couldn't understand it. After our trip, I would speak to Carl Brusau, executive director of the Mulanya Mountain Conservation Trust. He explained that the forests on this African island in the sky, as he described it, had a long and troubled history. Much of the mountain was once covered in Mulanya cedar, said Brusalo. Mulanya cedar, a tropical conifer that grew to around 150 feet and could be 5 feet in diameter, is endemic to the Mulanya Mountains. Straight-grained, hard-as-iron, and termite-proof, Mulanya cedar was highly sought after for the construction of buildings and bridges. Consequently, it was intensely logged from the beginning of the 1900s, when Malawi was a British colony, known as Nyasaland, straight through to the country's independence in 1964. Despite the Mulanya Mountains being described as a forest preserve as early as 1927. For many decades, Brusso said, there was a miles-long cable that airlifted equipment, including trucks and tractors, up into the mountains. As in many countries in Africa, Malawi's population has exploded. 50 years ago, there were about 5 million people in Malawi. Today, there are more than 20 million. The economy has not kept up with the increase in population. It is the world's fourth poorest country, according to the World Bank, with 2/3 of the nation living in extreme poverty and many people surviving on just $2 to $3 a day. Over the course of the 20th century, the Mulanya Mountains became the top source of firewood for cooking for almost 500,000 villagers surrounding the reserve, aided and abetted by what is widely described as a corrupt Malawian forestry department. Not surprisingly, Mulanya cedar is now almost extinct. The Mulanya Mountain Conservation Trust, or MMCT, was founded in 2000 to save the mountains from total destruction. After years of failed attempts to work effectively with the forestry department, Brusso said, we realized our only hope was to work directly with villagers. With funding from the World Bank, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, and the U.S. Forest Service, the MMCT started 13 nurseries for Mulanya cedar. Between 2004 and 2016, the trust planted tens of thousands of seedlings each year, and sometimes as many as 150,000. Nursery management and much of the planting was done by women, providing desperately needed income for poor families. The trust also hired local men as woodcutters to remove the invasive Mexican weeping pines the British had planted once the cedar was gone, in an attempt to bring back a balance of indigenous species. That's why the Chambé Plateau was barren. We employed well over 1,000 people for this project, Brousseau said. We have now planted over 1.5 million Mulania cedar seedlings. Still, he acknowledged that more needs to be done to ensure that the cedar saplings survive. The Mulania cedar is a keystone species, he went on, but it is just one part of an entire ecosystem. We are also planting 15 other indigenous species to provide cover and fire protection. Our goal is to return the natural biodiversity to the landscape. To this end, Brousseau and the MMCT have created a comprehensive ecological and social regeneration proposal currently under review in the Malawian government and with potential donor NGOs. It can't just be about trees, he explained. Protecting Mulania requires a multi-sector approach. Forests, yes, but also tourism, cultural preservation, water management, irrigation, and hydropower. Stima and I crossed the Chambé Plateau and noticed that the nascent heads of small plants had sprouted everywhere. These spriglets heartened me. With any luck in a decade, this mountain basin will be rewilded. Without forest cover, the hiking was hot, and we stopped to cool down in a clear pool fed by a murmuring stream. I removed my shoes and waded in, gripping the cool sand on the river bottom with my overheated toes. The water was not only potable, it was delicious. The Mulania Mountains are the major watershed for southeastern Malawi, containing the headwaters of 9 rivers that supply water for hundreds of thousands of Malawians. Without forests in this heat, the mountains' rivers would slowly dry up. Eventually, we left the cool water and headed straight uphill beneath the tyrannical tropical sun. The trail runs along the top of a ridge, then switches back steeply down to a sharp-sided pass no wider than the trail. There was a precipitous 1,000-foot drop to either side. Birds appeared to be using this as a pass over the mountains. I spotted a raptor, which I later identified as a booted eagle, then a lizard buzzard, and a plethora of other winged creatures I could not identify. In the least disturbed regions of the Mulania Mountains, the bird life is off the charts, with 249 known species, including the blue-billed teal, the harlequin quail, the emerald-spotted wood dove, and the fiery-necked nightjar. Across the pass, we followed the path through a small stand of tall trees when I suddenly heard the distinctive thunk of an axe. From its deep resonance, I could tell a large tree was being felled. I jumped to the conclusion that this was an illegal woodcutting, but Stima reassured me. "No, no," he said, "fire breaks." Forest fires are a constant threat on Mount Mulania, often set by locals to drive animals from the forest into their nets. These include the blue duiker, the bush hyrax, the blue monkey, the red bush squirrel, the Mozambique dwarf galago, the rusty spotted gannet, the African palm civet, and even the endangered Malawa chameleon. To keep small fires from getting out of control and consuming the entire mountain, the MMCT hires a crew of full-time woodcutters to chop firebreaks through the forests. In the past 20 years, they have created more than 500 miles of firebreaks. Just as we begin to rise out of the forests into alpine environs, a lovely mist settled around us. We passed into heath and stony highlands. The rocks on the trail became treacherously slippery, but I was so delighted to be out in the open, I practically skipped uphill. Coming over a bald expanse of rock, we were surprised to see tiny bright dots on the trail far out in front of us. As we closed the distance, the dots turned into people wearing colorful raincoats. An English family of four, parents and their two teenagers, and their guides and porters, 11 in total. We all rolled into the Chisepo hut around 1 p.m., the surrounding mountains of stone half hidden in swirls of mist. In total, there are 10 huts in the mountains, 9 of them maintained by the MMCT, the Forestry Department and the Mountain Club of Malawi, founded in 1952 by a group of energetic expatriates who were regular climbers on Mount Melania, according to the club's website. Their ramshackle wooden cottages, a spacious veranda, wooden table and bench, corrugated roof that roars inspiringly during mountain thunderstorms, and an outhouse. The 10th hut is privately owned and operated. Each hut has a caretaker who will, for a couple of dollars, get a fire going in the stone hearth for you. The cookware was a bit beat up, and the sleeping mats could have used a wash, but it was a refuge from the rain and wind. Steema retired to the porter's cabin, where he fell asleep in a pile of sleeping bags. The English mother was slightly altitude sick and took a nap, while the teenagers did their homework. I set myself up on the veranda with a book and read a little Melania history as the tin roof rattled with rain. Early humans are thought to have been living on the shores of Lake Malawi more than 80,000 years ago. Between the 15th and 18th century, Malawi was part of the Maravai Confederacy that stretched from modern-day Zambia to the coast of Mozambique. By the 1600s, the Portuguese had arrived, trading goods and introducing intercontinental slavery. The British moved in by 1891. The first European to record seeing Mount Melania in 1859 was Scotsman David Livingstone, the proselytizing explorer and devout abolitionist. He was followed by missionaries intent on converting the Malawian population to Christianity. Today, more than three-quarters of Malawians are Christians. The first anti-colonial freedom fighter in Malawi, John Chilembri, was a Baptist minister. Chilembri was assistant to British Baptist minister Joseph Booth from 1892 to 1895 in Blantyre, some 40 miles west of Mount Melania, then sailed to the United States, where he attended Virginia Theological Seminary. Returning to Malawi in 1900, Chilembri was outraged by the brutality of white plantation owners toward black workers. At the beginning of World War II, poor black Malawians, many of them abused and mistreated, were being conscripted to fight the Germans. With hundreds of followers, Chilembe attacked one of the worst of the plantations, beheading a manager who was known for his brutal treatment of workers. The colonial government quickly retaliated, executed 40 of the rebels, imprisoned another 300, tracked down Chilembre along the Melania Mountains near the Mozambique border, and shot him dead. Chilembre, leader of the first fight for independence in Malawi, is a national hero. Since 2016, his countenance have been on the 2,000 kwacha note, about $1.20. We rose the next morning at 4:30 while everyone else was fast asleep. After slugging down peanut butter sandwiches, we headed out with headlamps. Within half an hour, we were able to shut off our lights. The landscape was a steep boulder field with 3-foot-tall tufts of mountain grass between the rocks. The trail wiggled disjointly up through the boulders, some of which were marked with red paint that kept us on track in case fog were to descend. It couldn't have been a more sublime morning. No wind, clear blue and purple skies. The sun slowly rising above the red dust, blanketing the savanna far below. It was the most fecund alpine terrain I had ever experienced, with lovely waist-high grass and the emblematic Velosia splendens, a shrub as tall as a human, with a thin trunk and a crown of spiky leaves, puncturing the skyline. The higher we scrambled, the more magical the terrain became. We hooked left around one boulder, right around another, circled an impasse, climbed up a rampart, scrambled directly over the hunchbacks of granite giants, then dropped down into the tall grass. Near the top, we had to crawl on our hands and knees through several caves. We reached the summit at 7 a.m. I slowly turned in a circle to absorb the majestic panorama. All of Southeast Africa was spread out below. Mozambique to the east, south, and west. Tanzania to the far northeast. Zambia to the far northwest. Every direction curved off into a distant haze, blurring the line between heaven and earth. That completes the article. The author, Mark Jenkins, last wrote for Smithsonian about the practice of farming lions in South Africa. His article that I just read was titled Malawi's Island in the Sky. This next article is from the prologue section of the magazine, titled Booking It, by Elizabeth Webster. Founding Father Benjamin Franklin knew better than most of the benefits of self-education. In 1727, he established the Philadelphia-based discussion group known as the Junto, which sought mutual improvement through intellectual dialogue. Yet while Franklin enjoyed the Junto's spirited and secret debates on matters moral and scientific, he became convinced that the group needed an authoritative library to referee basic facts. Books were rare and expensive in colonial America, but Franklin had an idea. He conceived of a library with a subscription fee, the Library Company of Philadelphia, which he founded in 1731. The Library Company allowed members, at first largely male artisans of modest means, to purchase shares in the library at a low cost. Members also built a sort of intellectual wealth with their shares, as they could be passed down from generation to generation. Since Franklin wished to ensure access to useful books, he favored volumes in English that could be more widely understood. The Library Company's catalog would respond to readers' fervent interests, and those readers kept multiplying. After early successes, the Library Company soon began allowing non-shareholders to borrow books too, requiring only a small fee as collateral. This innovative structure quickly inspired imitators, and by 1800, there were more than 40 lending libraries throughout the United States. During the same era in Britain, philanthropists donated books to libraries for community enhancement, but only among the stacks. These libraries did not generally circulate books. In some instances, books were chained to bookshelves to prevent theft. By 1771, as the Revolution neared, Franklin reflected in his autobiography on the lending library's crucial role in fostering democracy. These libraries have improved the general conversation of the Americans and made the common tradesmen and farmers as intelligent as most gentlemen from other countries. From the Revolutionary War until 1800, the Library Company served as the first de facto Library of Congress, while the federal government was in Philadelphia. Still supported by shareholders, the library company today stands as an independent research library, free and open to the public. Some of its earliest holdings, such as Franklin's original copy of Logic or The Art of Thinking by Antoine Arnauld and Pierre Nicole, are preserved in its vast, non-circulating collection. Though the library company currently specializes in American history before 1900, its mission remains the same. The founders knew that democracies were inherently fragile, and that the only way you could sustain a democracy was by having an educated populace, says Michael J. Barsanti, the director of the library company. That's one of our first, most important roles as an institution, and it's one that we still have today. We are trying to remind people, using the junto as our inspiration, that we learn best when we learn together. That's the end of the article titled Booking It by Elizabeth Webster. And that completes the broadcast for today. I hope you enjoyed it. This was the Smithsonian Program. It's brought to you by Sunsounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. I've been reading from the April-May 2024 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sunsounds of Arizona. And if you've missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the Sunsounds.org website, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then click on Demand. Here you'll see a list of articles available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.